Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Good evening. I've been expecting you. Won't you join me?
As is typical for us this time of year, with Halloween just a week or so away, we take a break from our normal fare to venture into the fun and fascinating world of the creepy crawly. We invite you to visit our archives to view some of our past Halloween shows on monsters, ancient astronauts, UFO cults, and Bigfoot. Today, though, we move into some new territory with a look at the living dead, which have become increasingly popular in modern literature and film thanks to shows such as The Walking Dead and movies like 28 Days Later. I am joined by an expert on this topic, Professor Roger Luckhurst, a professor of modern and contemporary literature in the Department of English and Humanities at the Birkbeck University of London. He is calling in from across the sea, so we apologize in advance for any audio quality problems, which we will blame on radiation from Venus. Professor Luckhurst earned his PhD at the University of Hull and is a world-renowned expert in science fiction, weird fiction, horror, and Iraq war literature. He is also involved in a project entitled The New Dead Undead Project that is described as collecting curious histories of lives lived on in deathly states from the mummified aristocracy of Egypt via the mesmerized, prematurely buried, catatonic, and cryogenically frozen, to the embalmed bodies of 20th century's key communist leaders, to the current crisis of medically extended yet minimally conscious lives. Yowza. Professor Luckhurst is the author of numerous books, including The Mummy's Curse, The True Story of a Dark Fantasy, The Trauma Question, Science Fiction, in Polity Press's Cultural History of Literature series, and The Invention of Telepathy, to name just a few works. Today we will talk about his new book, Zombies, A Cultural History. And we will also link to his website where you can find these books and his other writings, so please check that out. Roger, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much for having me.
Growing up as a kid, I was always drawn to monster movies and science fiction, and my favorites tended toward the aquatic lizard category because I just loved the endless supply of Godzilla movies, and The Creature from the Black Lagoon was one of my favorite films when I was a kid. But I also became a big fan of zombie films when they started to appear more frequently in the early 1980s. And I have to admit, I never thought in a million years that someone could make a career out of studying this. So the obvious first question is, how did you get such an awesome job?
Well, it doesn't seem so awesome to me. It seems quite ordinary. I think there are hundreds of people who work on Gothic literature. You do get a few frowns from people who might work on proper things, like Chaucer and Shakespeare and so on. But the whole sense of teaching literature has changed in my generation. And it means that we look at lots and lots of popular literature, popular fiction, urban folklore. You can cross between literature, film, gaming, and so on, so that there's loads and loads of materials that you can work on. And there just happens to be a group of us who work on dead things.
Do you have any relevant background, perhaps dating to childhood? Were you watching science fiction movies like myself or reading books and the like?
Well, I think some people say that my generation, so I'm in my late 40s now, were alive in their teens at a really crucial moment. In the late 1970s. So I've written two books, one on Alien, which came out in 1979, and one on The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's film, which came out in 1980. And those were really crucial influences for many people. There was also something in Britain in around that time when the BBC showed double bills of horror films on Saturday night. And for some strange and completely irresponsible reason, my parents allowed me to watch those. So I think at that point I was completely corrupted.
Yeah, we had the same thing. We usually had Saturday morning monster movie fair, and I'm a few years older than you are. And right. That was when we only had three channels, and so that's what you got up in the morning and watched. Did you have any particular films that were really memorable for you? I remember actually watching The Shining. I didn't like The Shining, but I have to admit, Creature from the Black Lagoon and stuff like that. Those were great. Any ones that appealed to you?
Yeah, I think there were important things just around that time. I mean, Halloween was very important, I think. And that, along with The Shining, was really important because although they look very familiar now, they were amongst the first films to use the Steadicam. So in a way, it was a kind of a whole new perceptual experience of horror, which you could do not in creepy old castles and so on, but actually in hotel corridors or in the tedious suburbs that Halloween was set in. And it felt like it had brought it right up to date. And I think that's what also Stephen King's novels were, when they were good in the 1970s, were so important for doing as well. So bringing the vampire mythology right up to date, and it could be happening just outside your window. So that sort of stuff, I think, was very important for me.
Now, you've been writing on The Shining, you've been writing on weird fiction and all that kind of stuff. How easy is it to craft a career in this territory? I mean, as you mentioned earlier, that a lot of people think, you know, Shakespeare and Chaucer is the work of the humanities, and that's what we should be properly studying. But do you get any kind of weird looks or blowback from any of your colleagues, or have they fully embraced what you've been doing?
Yeah, well, I used to, and I wouldn't. I'm very careful with my PhD students that they make sure that they're appealing to a broad and more mainstream canonical kind of literature. But it's, as I say, it's much easier to do this kind of material now. But I did my PhD on a British science fiction writer called J.G. Ballard, who is probably most famous for Empire of the Sun, Steven Spielberg's film. And I was told continually while I was doing that PhD that I should really tie him to someone sensible, someone proper, like William Golding, who'd won the Nobel Prize, or Iris Murdoch. And actually, funnily enough, you know, we don't really read those two so much anymore, and now it's J.G. Ballard who's seen as the key figure of the post-war era. So things have changed, but you still do get some strange looks. The second in command of my college the other day did raise his eyebrow at the fact I'd written an essay about tentacle and teaching in the Times Higher Education Supplement recently.
I have got to get a hand on that article, Tentacles and Teaching. Ah, that's fantastic. And I like the forward thinking that you do. I mean, you're talking about J.G. Ballard, and you know, people are saying, well, he's not going to be important. But, you know, later on, he does become important. Oftentimes, we see these things in the rearview mirror from far away. And the folks who can pick up the scent early on, I think, are the really creative leaders. I like to somehow think of my research as been doing that as well. Mm. But let's move on to the work of zombies. Why specifically a book on zombies? The stories of the undead have been around for eons, but zombies, they've only been making this huge cultural appearance in popular fiction in maybe the last, I don't know, two or three decades, perhaps dating back to George Romero's Night of the Living Dead being a precursor of what's to come. So what fascinated you about zombies?
Yeah, it's true that modern zombies, so the hordes of zombies, are associated with Night of the Living Dead in 1968, that was. But in fact, Romero didn't use the word zombie in that film, and they're not zombies. Mm. They are, in fact, ghouls, that North African notion of creatures that hang around in cemeteries. And he didn't even use zombies in his second film either, 10 years later. So he nevertheless produced this whole genre and gave in himself in the end to using the word zombies. And what I wanted to do was to try and... You get lots and lots of histories of the films, and people don't really know where this word comes from, its culture, how long it's been hanging around in American culture, in fact, since the 1920s, and that it had emerged in the Caribbean in the 19th century. So I wanted to provide a history for people to get a handle on where this strange modern mythology had come from.
Yeah, you mentioned that George Romero didn't use the word zombie. He said that they're ghouls. And one of the things that you start off in your book is to differentiate what we're actually talking about when we talk about the undead. You tend to give some kind of scope to your study. And there's a lot of different words that come up, exotics, ghouls, mummies. Where do all these things fit in?
Well, I think we need to see that something like a vampire comes from a very specific context, and it appeared in Europe in the 1730s, and it was always an example of the stupid superstitions of people further east, so from the very edges of Europe. So in a way, it's kind of saying we are enlightened and sensible people, and look at how stupid these peasants are over here. And the zombie is exactly the same for America. So in the 1920s, when America was occupying Haiti, they were intent on stamping out superstitions amongst the peasantry. And their perfect example of this was the voodoo religion, and particularly the belief in the zombie. The irony being, of course, that what happens is that the people who try and stamp this out become absolutely infected with the beliefs themselves.
Mm.
So actually now, I think it's, in America, a vast proportion of the population believe in ghosts. They watch zombie films all the time. Their most popular TV shows are about zombies and vampires. And they're the ones who are now considered to be, you know, the superstitious, credulous ones.
Hmm.
So I love this story. I love how it twists and turns.
So give us a little bit of history of all of this. And one of the questions, too, that comes up is the word ghoul. I mean, was the word ghoul used prior to this in voodoo culture? Was it zombies? Where does all this stuff come from? And where do the undead first make their appearance in modern literature?
Sure. Well, I think, again, you have to follow which strand. So vampires have a very clear emergence in the 18th century. We know about mummies from Egypt and around the world, actually, but particularly Egypt in the 19th century. And they only really become nasty and cursed creatures in the late 19th century, as soon as Britain occupies Egypt, so there's a very clear political link there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the zombie, this is a very different thing. So it's from a very particular context in Haiti. Haiti, as we might know, was the first ever post-colonial nation. It was a slave colony of France, which had a slave rebellion, which was successful. And in 1804, it became an independent country. And at that point, of course, the white European imperial nations utterly demonized Haiti as this place of savagery, cannibalism, primitivism, and lots of stories about eating of the dead, boiling of children in pots and pans, all of this terrible kind of cliched stuff about the so-called primitive races. And as far as I can tell, the word zombie without an E on the end, which is probably a West African word, was first used in an American literary text in 1889 by a brilliant writer called Lafcadio Hearn. And then his discussion is with one of his servants, that he's constantly saying to them, I keep hearing this word zombie, what is it? And he gets a bewildering set of answers that he can make no sense of at all. It's a three-legged horse. It's a ghost that you see hanging from trees. It's a possessed dog that you meet at a crossroads. It's the spirit that is invisible that occupies your house. So it means lots and lots of different things at that point. And the figure of that we recognize as the undead creature, the creature who's been reanimated and is enslaved to a voodoo priest, that comes into American culture only in the 1920s through the amazing writings of a man called William Seabrook, who went to Haiti in 1929.
Yeah, let's...
And it's his work that produces the first film, White Zombie. So that's where it comes from.
Yeah, let's talk about some of these characters here. The two people that stand out early in the book are Lafcadio Hearns, and you said that he's a great writer. And what makes him a great writer? I mean, I'm not a literature guy, so I wouldn't know what great writing is if it bit me. But what you mentioned that. Why would you consider him to be a great writer?
Oh, well, he's got an extraordinary life, really. So he was someone who was half Irish, half Greek, who was educated in Paris, and then became a bohemian. And many people say that he traveled to America and, in effect, invented New Orleans, that sort of sense of the occult, hoodoo, voodoo kind of culture. He wrote journalism about this kind of material, but he wrote it in a really manneristic, very decadent 19th century heightened style. Wasn't really a straightforward journalist at all, and nevertheless was sent to the Caribbean to investigate and write travel narratives, and that's where he writes his story about zombies in Martinique. And then amazingly, he then traveled to Japan, fell in love with Japan, fell in love with a Japanese woman, and married her and became a Japanese figure. And he collected ghost stories in Japan, and that's actually what he's famous for. They're incredibly beautifully crafted stories. So actually, he's not particularly known for his moments of discussion about zombies. He's much more famous for his collection of Japanese ghost stories. So he's a really incredible just transitional figure. He died in 1904.
It's interesting to say that he wrote in a very decadent, manneristic style. When you think of the late Victorian age, the late 1800s or so, you think of it very prim and proper. But, I mean, were these pretty salacious writings, travel writings, and books at the time?
Well, Lafcadio Hearns was relatively bohemian, and his books on Martinique are definitely very interested in grading the types of women that he's seeing for the first time, almost like Picasso or someone who's fascinated, utterly full of desire for these African iconographies and so on. And Lafcadio Hearns was the same. So he was really interested in the exotic, in the beyond, something beyond the West, things outside his education and culture. And we see that often in decadent people like Charles Baudelaire or Arthur Rimbaud or Oscar Wilde. So he's very much in that vein.
Okay. Now, another person that you mentioned, and this guy plays a pretty big role in your book and really setting the zombie narrative forward, is this William Seabrook. And if Lafcadio Hearns has a very interesting history, Seabrook just cranks that up a notch. Tell us about him.
Okay. William Seabrook is just so extraordinary a figure. He was writing in the 1910s and 1920s. And at the time, he was the most famous feature writer in the American Flick magazine. And he was sent around the world to report in the most lurid, salacious terms his various adventures. So he went to, for example, Arabia and was living in a tent with the Bedouin for a couple of years. His badge of honor was that he was offered several wives for his, his impressive ability to meld in. And then famously, he was paid to go to West Africa to join a cannibal cult and to eat human flesh, which he tried to do. But the French colonial police were too much in control of the population. So in the end, he had to go back to Paris, and he went to a morgue. He purchased an arm and then went home and cooked it.
Yeah.
So he's that kind of figure, really.
Yeah, he also spent time with Aleister Crowley as well, too. So a lot of these really interesting characters of the time blend together.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, he knew basically everyone. He hang out with lots and lots of famous modernist writers, Thomas Mann and Jean Cocteau, Crowley, Hemingway, all these sorts of people. So he was very well known, not least for his very exuberant sadomasochistic relationship.
Yeah, so very interesting. And he also wrote what seems to be a very important book in terms of the zombie genre, which was called The Magic Island. Tell us a little bit about that book.
Yeah, that's right. So part of his exotic adventures were being sent to Haiti in 1929. So America was still occupying this, and he became friends with various Marines and people who were governing bits of the island. And they would take him to see voodoo displays. And he was beginning to hear stories about zombies or the undead. And one of his guides just said to him, oh, well, there are some just down the road. I'll tell you to go and have a look. And his famous chapter is called Dead Men Working in Cane Fields, where he is introduced to three or four of these figures who are, you know, absolutely in front of him. They are clearly vacant, dead, yet still working in the field. And he's completely freaked out by this and tries to think of various rationalizations for what it is that he's seeing, and decides that in a way what it must be is a kind of catatonic state where people are kind of alive and yet dead. And he rationalizes it like that. I mean, one of the ways you could see that scenario is that, of course, what he's meeting are people who've been working in the fields for over 20 hours under slave conditions. They're working for the American Sugar Corporation, trying to pay off debts. So if you're working that hard, if you've reestablished slavery, it might well be that what you're looking at is a very political form of deadness.
And how does this book then push forward zombie genre and move us forward in terms of the history of how this starts to weave into pulp fiction during the early 1900s?
Sure. I mean, I think the Seabrook's Magic Island is very much a travel narrative. It's not a piece of fiction at all. And actually, what you begin to see in the 1920s, when all of these pulp magazines were selling in their tens of millions in America, you begin to get stories set in very exotic places, full of supernatural events. And the best, the most thrilling, are the ones that are in this kind of zone of uncertainty. So you go to Haiti, everyone knows this kind of is a place of the supernatural and the weird and the uncanny. No one quite knows what the zombie is. We know that there are voodoo priests. We know that the native population did poison its colonial administrators sometimes in the 18th century. Is this happening again? So you get lots of spooky stories about voodoo priests. And of course, the logic is that you then bring that back home. So there is a huge population migrating from Haiti into New Orleans, but also up the East Coast. And you begin to get really thrilling stories about evil masterminds who are able to use voodoo to send people into these undead states. So that's the whole sensation fiction that happens in the 1920s and 1930s. And it gets into film in Hollywood in 1932 with White Zombie. Not so successful, but it then carries on in magazines, in comics, in the 1940s and 1950s. And then it absolutely explodes with people like Romero in the 1960s.
Let's step back to this movie, White Zombie, and the pulp fiction narratives of the early part of the 20th century. The cultural context at this time becomes very important. First of all, we're getting the expansion of mass media, and pulp fiction becomes very important at this time. Printing is easier to get out to people. More people are literate.
Yeah.
But, you know, as we've talked to other people on the program before on Monsters, that all of this is set into a cultural context, too, wherein themes that are going on politically and socially work their way into these novels. And, you know, for instance, you could be thinking of alien invasion movies in the 1950s and 60s as a metaphor for the, you know, Red Scare or for the Soviet Union. How does what's going on with zombies in terms of that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think this is what this is why they're so great to teach, right? So that you always say to students, what's it really about? What do you think is going on underneath the surface? And I think when you look at something like Romero fiction in the late 1960s, you've got mass hordes of zombies attacking a group of people holed up in a farmhouse. What's that really about in an absolutely febrile atmosphere of 1968, you know, and it's clearly a sort of allegory of Vietnam and of the civil rights movement, the fact that film has a lead black actor involved, full of explosive moments where he shoots down the white patriarch and so on. So you can begin to see that the zombie is a very rich kind of metaphor, an allegory or other things. And in the 1930s, I think it's clearly an anxiety about how America is expanding its empire into the Pacific, into the Caribbean, and into the southern part of the Americas. And we know that that had a very difficult, traumatic part of development, full of difficulties, political difficulties, civil wars, all kinds of nefarious activities going on there. And the zombie is a figure of anxiety, I think, about the native populations might well be able to revenge themselves, to turn power back on itself, to undercut. And this is what curse stories have done for millennia. The curse is issued by people who have no power, no political power, and yet have some kind of supernatural ability to undercut the great powers that are oppressing them. So I think the zombie is a figure in that way. And you might speculate that The Walking Dead right now is full of those similar kind of anxieties about the precariousness of American family, American middle class, all of these forces that are massing at the gates, that a lot of rhetoric that we've heard in the last few months during the election are really ramping up as well. Hmm. So I think always the zombie is political.
Yeah. In terms of the reception of this in the 1930s, the movie that you mentioned that really brings it to the forefront is White Zombie. How was that received critically and popularly by the public?
Well, like all origin stories, the White Zombie is important for being one of the first. But actually, it didn't do that well. It wasn't actually a Hollywood film. It was an independent film, which was made on the back of the Universal Studios 1932 boom in horror movies, as they were being called. So White Zombie starred Bela Lugosi, who had just been in Dracula. And in fact, they used the same set. they filmed at night on the same sets because they were cheap. And basically, it's the same plot. So Bela Lugosi, this time, is a master of voodoo. He's able to hypnotize the beautiful white blonde woman who's just arrived on the island. And he is finally defeated by his zombie horde that he thinks he is in control of. And it's all very creaky, quite static. It's an early sound movie, so not much movement on the set. They did okay, but it didn't really fly. And it was only really with I Walked with a Zombie, that wonderful film by Jack Turner in 1943, that actually really secured the zombie in film.
Yeah, take us through that history then. How do we get from White Zombie to, let's say, 1968's The Night of the Living Dead? The stuff in film is going on, but is there also work in literature that you start to see this in popular novels during this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the most surprising to me elements of working on this history was trying to work out precisely that leap. What happens between 1932 and 1968, so White Zombie and Night of the Living Dead? And I came to the conclusion that actually the late 1940s was very important. I mean, if you think about it, we're in a moment where there's a whole new conception of the masses of the undead. In White Zombie, there are only three zombies, and they are subject to enchantment by a particular priest. And this is not like the zombie horde that we get much later. What happens in 1945 is, of course, we come out of the Second World War immensely traumatized by all kinds of revelations, not just from the concentration camps, which were full of tens of thousands of people who were living in this undead state, but also the dropping of the atom bomb. And also, I think the Korean War is very important too, because of this idea of Mao Zedong's of using the human wave, sending masses and masses and masses of peasants against American soldiers. And you see that image repeated in zombie fiction and film over and over again, this overwhelming horde of the other coming at you. So I think there's something going on there which locates the zombie in a very traumatic post-Second World War moment.
Yeah, you can also see this, and it is interesting that you mentioned another book and movie in relation to this, which was The Manchurian Candidate. That yes. You talked about the Red Horde, but it took over somebody and reconceptualized them into a robotic or, you know, not of themselves type of person.
That's right. In slang in America in the 1950s, you could call someone a robot or a zombie, and they were kind of interchangeable, actually. And in Richard Condon's novel of The Manchurian Candidate, this guy who's been hypnotized and programmed by post-hypnotic suggestion, brainwashed to be this assassin, is called both a zombie and a robot in interchangeable terms. So I think to be a zombie is someone who, at this point, you can be deadened by mass culture, by political discourse, by a kind of religion. You can be brainwashed in all kinds of ways.
Mm. Now, one of the people that we haven't talked about, and she appears more in the early to mid part of the 20th century, is this Zora Neale Hurston. So a lot of white writers are actually writing about zombies, but you talk about this female author in a way that's really interesting because it brings authenticity to the zombie genre. Explain what her role in crafting this genre was all about.
Yeah, Zora Neale Hurston might be a surprising figure to be involved in this because most people know her as a Harlem Renaissance novelist. So she wrote novels in that huge efflorescence of Harlem black culture in the 1920s and 30s. But what people perhaps don't know is that she was trained as an anthropologist at Columbia University by Franz Boas, one of the very famous first anthropologists. And he thought it was a great opportunity to have a black woman who could be sent in the field and probably gain information that other people couldn't gain. And she ended up doing field work with a voodoo priestess in New Orleans, and she started training herself. And she writes a very, very strange report, which suggests that actually she began to experience things that her anthropological training couldn't quite deal with or cope with. And she doesn't really go into any detail at all about that. She then, a couple of years later, goes to Haiti and does the same thing. She joins a voodoo group. She starts training with a voodoo priest. And then, very remarkably, she goes to meet a zombie. And not only that, takes the first photograph of a real, actual zombie. And firmly says in her very strange book about this experience called Tell My Horse, that she firmly believes that zombies exist, that she has encountered them, and also that she got the hell out of Haiti as fast as she could because she thought she was being poisoned by a secret voodoo cult.
Let's bring this up now to George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, which is the landmark movie that I think brings zombies up into the contemporary period. What was so important about that film, and more importantly, and you make a very interesting case about this, his follow-up film, Dawn of the Dead, was even more important than that first one. And I have to say that I was very pleased about that, because when I was growing up as a kid, we would that was one of the films that we'd always go see at midnight showings. And I must have seen that film at least 24 times. And we memorized the dialogue, and it was kind of like our Rocky Horror Picture Show. So explain Romero's role in this and this shift between Night of the Living Dead to Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, so Night of the Living Dead was made in 1968, and it was made totally outside the film industry, just by a group of people who got together in Pittsburgh. They had some film experience because they made adverts for local TV and stuff. They made it at the weekends. They put it together. And the point is that they were completely outside any horror rules, any film rules. So the Hays Code was still around, just about, although people were not really observing it. But there's a genuine sense when you watch Night of the Living Dead that they are going to do something that you've never seen before, that's utterly transgressive, that actually there are no rules here. And it is incredibly gruesome, very, very explicit and physical, and it's a total transformation of the mythology. I mean, importantly, actually, it was a loose adaptation of Richard Matheson's novel I Am Legend, which was actually about the last human being alive when the rest of the world has been turned into vampires, which is why Night of the Living Dead is only retrospectively considered to be a zombie film, I think. So it was incredibly transgressive, not least because it was released in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War. And the last scene where you see the black hero shot down by what is obviously a white posse is an incendiary racial statement in 1968, as, you know, the Watts riots and so on had happened in the last couple of years. So it was hugely important politically, and it became a cult film in the counterculture, and one of the first ever midnight movies, in fact, but shown on campuses around America, shown at the Museum of Modern Art in 1970 as the new kind of political filmmaking. So incredibly important. And nevertheless, Romero couldn't get inside the Hollywood system at all. But his follow-up film in this genre anyway, he made several others, was called Dawn of the Dead. But it was funded by Italian filmmakers and studios who had a huge industry of making really gruesome horror films. And they were the ones who called it the zombie. So when Dawn of the Dead came out in 1978, it was really overtly a political, satirical use of the figure of the zombie, because this, of course, is a film set mainly in a shopping mall. And in fact, it was one of the first ever indoor purpose-built shopping malls in the world. And happened to be a friend of George Romero, who was building it and was the speculator. So they got inside and used this space. And they're very clearly saying that this zombie horde that are wandering around this shopping mall are basically us. You know, it's no longer an exotic creature to be scared of that's coming from somewhere else, from some primitive culture. The zombies are actually us. We're the stupid ones that have just followed our consumerist beliefs and obsession with buying stuff. So even when we die, we're going to go back to the shopping mall and keep on shopping. And that sort of sense of the zombie as an overtly satirical object was really important for making the zombie incredibly fashionable for critics of American society who could use the supernatural and the zombie and the vampire as well to begin to critique modern life. So that's why it's so important.
One of the things that happened with Dawn of the Dead, and it seems like such a cheesy and corny movie, but if you just look at it from the outside, the happy, cheery shopping mall, but then the zombies there, and then you see the internal tension of the living characters that are in there. Later on, 20 years or so later, they made a remake of it, and they tried, I think, in many ways to update it. Cinematography, the filming is a little bit, you know, what you would consider more up to date with special effects and stuff. What was your take on that? Because I saw the remake of Dawn of the Dead and I did not like it at all.
Well, if it's one of your key childhood films, yeah, which it sounds like it was, then, you know, they're never going to live up to that, I think.
Yeah.
The horror industry is ruthlessly commercial itself. So we're in a cycle of remakes from the 1970s, which is upsetting all kinds of people. Actually, with the Dawn of the Dead, I did think that the opening sequence was absolutely incredible. So this is within 3 minutes, you get the absolute destruction of this family unit. So the daughter turns on the mother, the husband becomes a monstrous figure who needs to be kind of killed off. And I thought it actually had a really immensely powerful, if very nihilistic, opening. But it didn't live up to it after.
Yeah. I'm going to have to go back and read or rewatch that film to see how it actually looks and plays out. In terms...
Well, just watch the pre-credit
sequence.
That's all you need to do.
Okay.
I tend to agree with you that it's not great.
A brief note for our listeners who made it to this point in the podcast. During the introduction, I apologize in advance for any audio problems we might have with the overseas call, and I blamed it on radiation from Venus, George Romero's go-to cause to move the plot of Night of the Living Dead along. Well, as it turns out, our Skype connection was affected by something last week. Radiation from Venus, I don't know. Anyways, we decided to do a short postponement and pick up here with the remainder of our conversation. Not quite 28 days later, but just a mere 4. So, Roger, thanks for returning and being my most patient Research on Religion guest.
You're welcome. It's obviously the dangerous storms or something in the air.
So let's go ahead and start where we left off last week, discussing where the zombie genre has gone since Dawn of the Dead. And it would seem like 28 days later becomes an important marking point. What has become of the undead narrative over the past 2 decades or so? Have there been any important developments?
I would say there are two really important developments. The first is that, as we see in 28 Days Later, zombies start to run. And some people get very upset by that. But actually what 28 Days Later does is introduce this idea that zombies are really part of our imagination of contagions, and particularly of global contagions. So this sense of the world being very rapidly transformed into a place of the undead is something you see again and again in Resident Evil or in World War Z, or World War Z, as I insist on calling it over here. And that's a key idea, I think, about how globally interconnected we are. So you move very quickly from a small house that's being besieged in Night of the Living Dead to visions of the whole globe being transformed. And I think it's quite an interesting way of us trying to imagine our interconnected world. So that's one key idea. The other one that I think is really interesting is the sense that zombies are beginning to acquire consciousness and subjectivity again. So they're able to think, speak, and we begin to experience their side of the story. So no longer a sense of an anonymous horde, but of zombies who are experiencing a weird transitional undead state. And there are some really good, important, interesting examples, like Warm Bodies, which was both a really good novel and also a very funny film, which is a kind of a remake of Romeo and Juliet, only between human and zombie, a romance between human and zombie. And then also TV series like iZombie is a good example too. And I think it's a really interesting sign that there is now a mainstream literary novel, Colson Whitehead's Zone 1, which is marking the arrival of a zombie out of the lowest possible trash culture and into mainstream culture. So those are the things I would say are emerging.
So any thoughts on the movement of zombies into traditional classic literature? And here I'm thinking of Pride and Prejudice and zombies. Are zombies going to take over all the previous great works that we've had, they had to read in college and high school?
Oh boy, I really hope not. I think it's a true story that the publishers thought up the title Pride and Prejudice and Zombies first, and then commissioned a book to fill out that title. And you can kind of see that it's a great title, but actually it's a sort of mashup idea that you get within one paragraph, and really I can't, it's almost unreadable, I think. And the film is terrible as well.
Yeah.
There have been some interesting transpositions of zombies into the past. That Abraham Lincoln was the vampire hunter, wasn't he, rather than a zombie hunter. But on the whole, I think that's a mashup genre, which I'm not sure is going to have many legs.
Yeah, I did watch the film. I actually kind of chuckled my way through it, if only because my wife had always wanted me to read Pride and Prejudice. And I said, okay, finally, I will do it. In terms of where the genre is moving, do you have any speculative thoughts on what the future of the undead might be?
Well, I mean, it is a really interesting question. This is a thing that I think is very striking from current medical research, which is that the definition of being dead has changed. We actually redefined death in 1968. It used to be the case that you defined physical death by the cessation of the heart. But in 1968, they decided to change that, partly as a result of medical developments around organ transplants and so on. And there's a real problem with organ transplants, because if you removed the organs of a person with a still-beating heart, you were committing murder. So what they did was change the definition to brain death. And that's been the case since the late 1960s. But increasingly, people are pushing the boundaries of what constitutes brain death. And of course, as we get older, and we are able to continue bodies continuing to be alive ever longer into over 100 years old, the problem of brain death is becoming more and more difficult to decide. And this whole wave of dementia, of Alzheimer's disease, is people often say, you know, the person is no longer there, that my relative is now dead, and although they're still alive, there's just a husk. What constitutes being alive? Is it being conscious? Is it having memories? Is it having connections? Or is it simply just being alive? So these ideas have produced new concepts like the minimally conscious state or the persistent vegetative state, all of which are incredibly contested by doctors, by medics, by theologians, by philosophers. And I think that's where we are. Actually, the boundaries of what constitutes the undead, this liminal state between life and death, is massively expanding. And it's a really interesting time, partly why I think we're so interested in zombies now.
And that takes me back to the broader scope of your research, which deals with trauma, science fiction, weird fiction, and this boundary of where death actually occurs. And one of the favorite questions I always ask my guests here on the show is, reflecting back upon your research over the past few decades, is there anything that has really changed your mind about the human condition, or that has surprised you in some way that you said, wow, 20 years ago, I never would have thought that. And now I'm a different thinker because of that.
That is a really good question. And I do think it's something to do with this sense of how we try and conceive of the boundaries of what it constitutes to be a human being. And having, as so many people in the world now have had this experience of a relative going through final phases of dementia, what I thought was a very trivial, really interested area of popular culture, you know, someone should be doing this stuff. We're so interested in this. Millions of people read this stuff and watch this stuff. What is it doing for us? We need to ask those sorts of questions. But actually, there's something profoundly personal and experiential for all of us, I think, in this major phase of technological, biological, medical transformation that means this popular culture is actually doing really serious work for us about what it means to be a human being. So this sense of, you know, how we might define personhood in this phase of the advancing age of our population seems to me really crucial, and that's what the undead, I think, in the end is all about.
Some very interesting thoughts for us to reflect upon, and I want to thank Roger Luckhurst for being on Research on Religion and being so patient for us. Roger, thanks for being on our show.
That was great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.
Ha, 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 ha.